that she'd never quite understood at the time, of how a Tibetan Buddhist monk, escaping the Chinese soldiers swarming through his country, had almost crossed the Himalayas to safety when he was told that his entire family, left behind after being given assurances of safety, had just been killed. And while his companions could only receive the news with horror, all the monk could do was laugh. "And how?" asked about the incident in later years, he had said that that was the nearest he had ever come to enlightenment. For everything was gone then, and there was nothing left but release.
"It's time," said Rossiter, staring at her from the open doorway.
"I'm ready," she said, getting to her feet with an almost beatific smile.
"All they want is one little piece of information," he said, showing the slightest touch of human warmth, something that he'd never shown before, as if, in the end, he wanted her to survive after all, despite everything. As if he couldn't understand why she wouldn't give in, when he most surely would.
"Just give them something. Anything."
"Thank you," she said, an almost mischievous sparkle in her eye. "But I'd rather die behind the chemical sheds."
"Then you have no fear any more," he said, trying to suppress a smile. "You are completely free." And he turned and left. Left the cell door standing open, too. Evie, completely taken aback, could only stand and stare. And eventually, listening to the footsteps receding down the corridor, choke out a single word.
"What?"
17. Stunned, Evie stepped toward the entrance, all her previous composure evaporating with every pace. She reached out to touch the door nervously, unable to quite believe it hadn't been relocked. Then, tentatively, she stuck her head out into the hall beyond, and saw nobody. This didn't make sense, but the guard had said she was free. And what had she got to lose now, when a few moments earlier she'd been expecting immediate execution? If they captured her again, she'd be no worse off than before. With that, she stepped out into the corridor and noticed that the plain brick wall with the poster pasted on it seemed to extend for only a few feet to either side. To the limits of her vision from the cell door grille, in fact, before being replaced by a much more normal plastered wall. That seemed strange in itself, but then, of course, she'd always made the journey from her cell to the interrogation room with a bag over her head. More puzzling was that there didn't seem to be any other grill-doored cells anywhere in sight, as if her own was the only one especially constructed for her alone. But that meant, of course, that there was no cell next door. No Valerie. Shaking her head in confusion, she walked, there just seemed no need to even think of running, toward its end, rounded the corner cautiously, and hesitated. Ahead of her stood a uniformed guard. Was it Rossiter? But something about his frozen stare, his absolute stillness, kept her from turning back. And the more she looked, the more lifeless he seemed. A mannequin. She strode toward him then, noticing a door behind him, a door that also opened as she turned the handle and pushed her way on through. The interrogation room next, with all its lights, far closer to her cell than it had ever seemed when she hadn't been able to see her way as they'd led her to it. Another mannequin sitting at the table. And underneath it, a tape player. Wires leading up to a small speaker by the mannequin's throat. And then another room, with a guard's uniform and a flesh mask she recognized as Rossiter's face. A Fedco uniform and another mask. Others still that were completely unfamiliar to her. And on a table, a small wire cage containing a rat. Her rat. What on earth did it all mean? Mannequins? Disguises? Cells that weren't really cells? A prison that wasn't really a prison? There was only one way to find out, and that was to continue until one of these doors opened to the outside world, or at least to something less confusing. The next door down the corridor was, finally, the one she sought. She opened it, tentatively, and cautiously stepped through, and found herself standing once more, to her most intense surprise, in the Shadow Gallery. The Shadow Gallery. At first it just didn't register properly. A place she'd never thought to see again, had no reason to expect that she'd ever be returning here. Was this, too, another pretense? A studio-set imitation of the real Shadow Gallery? No. Somehow, as she ran her eyes over the assembled treasures the place contained, she knew that this was the real thing. Which meant that her prison had always been part of the Shadow Gallery, too. But how could it be? Disbelief almost overwhelmed her, but there was V, standing before her, wearing his mask as always, and this was definitely not a mannequin. "Hello, Evie," he said simply, with a certain warmth that indicated a pride in her accomplishments, though little more than that, as if he was waiting for a chance to judge what her reaction might be. Pleasure. Shock. Disgust. But her first reaction was one of complete incomprehension.
"You,"
she began, startled, but then her mouth simply hung open while she stared. At him, at where she was, at a world that was not contained entirely in the concept prison cell.
"It was you," she said at last. "That wasn't real. Is Gordon—"
"I'm sorry, but Mr. Dietrich is dead," he told her, genuine compassion in his voice. "I thought they'd just arrest him, but when they found the Quran in his house, and everything else, they had him executed." The Quran wouldn't have been half of it, she knew. Not even a small part. Among all the other stuff, it would have been God Save the Queen that got Gordon killed.
"Oh, God,"
said Evie flatly, hearing everything she'd suspected now finally confirmed. "Fortunately," V continued gently, "I got to you before they did."
"You got to me?"
she said, not quite understanding the significance of his words.
"You did this to me?"
And then it hit her. All that had happened in the last, how long was it? Days, weeks, months, had all been his doing. Rossiter, the interrogator, him in disguise, and that Fedco truck in the street on the Sunday night that she'd arrived in Bloomsbury, that must have been him as well, keeping an eye on her whereabouts in disguise. But mainly, he'd been Rossiter. She stumbled back against the wall, feeling as if her legs would hardly support her.
"You cut my hair! You tortured me! You tortured me!"
She began to shake, realizing at last just how thin she'd become, how weak, how sick. And V nodded his head almost sadly, admitting and confirming everything.
"Why?"
she asked him disbelievingly.
"God, why?"
He hesitated then, as if having to explain his actions was almost as painful as having carried them out in the first place. "You said you wished to live without fear. I wish there was an easier way, but there wasn't." Evie felt her stomach turning over and covered her mouth as she began to retch, but there was nothing in her stomach to bring up. "I know you may never forgive me," V said, taking a pace toward her as if genuinely concerned. "Nor will you ever understand how hard it was for me to do what I did. Every day I saw in myself what you see in me now. Every day I wanted to end it. But each time you refused to give in, I knew I couldn't."
"You're sick!"
she cried, looking up at him with a gaze that made him pause.
"You're evil!"
"You could have ended it, Evie," he said contemplatively. "You could have given in, but you didn't. Why?" And with that question, he began to move toward her again, seeming to offer comfort and support. Back against the wall she slid away, looking toward him as if he were some sort of cockroach. Worse by far than her cell companion, the rat. At least she'd been able to understand what the rat did.
"Leave me alone!" she shouted at him. "I hate you!"
"That's it," he said, coming to a halt once more, giving her space. "At first I thought it was hate, too. Hate was all I knew. Hate had built my world, imprisoned me, taught me how to eat hate, how to drink hate, how to breathe hate. I thought I would die from the hate in my veins, but something happened. It happened to me just as it happened to you. Evie turned away from him then, snapping her eyes shut and covering both ears with her hands.
Shut up!
She screeched, shaking now with stress and nervous tension as well as the sheer physical weakness left over from her ordeal.
I don't want to hear any more of your lies!
Your father said that artists use lies to tell the truth, he reminded her. Yes, I created a lie, and because you believed it, you found out something true about yourself.
No!
She shouted, hunching over, trying to get away, to make him stop, to make everything stop. What was true in that cell is just as true now, V told her insistently, adding pointedly, what you felt in there had nothing to do with me.
I can't feel anything anymore.
Don't run from it, he carried on, in that same annoying, unrelenting way that she'd found unnerving about him right from the start, that way he had of forcing her to face unpleasant truths. You've been running all your life.
Oh, God!
She gasped suddenly, falling to her knees, starting to curl into a fetal ball as the panic attack arrived with unstoppable force.
I can't breathe!
Wheezing and moaning, she managed to choke out.
Asthma! When I was little!
But after that, the words wouldn't come any more than the breaths, and Evie felt that this collapse of her body was another final betrayal, and she could do nothing else but cry. Listen to me, Evie, he said in a tone of quiet command. This may be the most important moment of your life. Commit yourself to it. She didn't want to hear it, didn't want anything except for all this to just stop. She closed her eyes as tightly as she could, but somehow the tears kept squeezing out, trickling down her cheeks. They took your parents from you. They took the man you'd come to love from you. They put you in a cell and took everything they could take except your life.
Please,
she managed to gasp, but nothing else would come out. And as V crouched down beside her and placed his hands on her shoulders, she began to bawl like a child. You believed that was all there was, didn't you? He said more gently now. That the only thing you had left was your life. But it wasn't, was it? Evie shook her head, tears burning her cheeks. But with that simple gesture of acknowledgement, just a little control came back to her. You found something else, he told her, and she knew he was right. Began to know, at last, that he'd been right about everything all along. In that cell you found something that mattered more to you than life itself, because when they threatened to take it, threatened to kill you unless you gave them what they wanted, you told them you would rather die. And with that, her breath began to come back. The panic began to subside, and she sucked in a great lungful of air. You faced your death, Evie, he said softly, almost whispering. You were calm. You were still. Try to feel now what you felt then. She did, and felt that release once more, that sense of putting down all the burdens of the world. And she started to feel a warmth spreading through her entire being, not just her body, but her mind, her soul, every part of her that had been, was now, would be in the future.
Oh, God, I felt,
she began, her eyes clearing now,
like an angel.
V nodded, remembering similar feelings of his own, and offered her his hand. She took it tentatively at first, then squeezed it tightly, a clasp more eloquent than words. She tried to rise to her feet, only to lurch against him helplessly, mental strength being quite unable to combat physical weakness.
I'm dizzy,
she said, raising her free hand to her forehead, grateful for his gloved hand and knowing that, without it, she'd be back down on the floor.
I need air. Please, I need to be outside.
There's a lift. It'll take us to the roof. And then he led her, still helping her walk, across the silent shadow gallery, and to a door she'd always assumed merely led to another room. Instead it opened to reveal the small elevator cage he'd mentioned. She had no idea how far they had to travel, though the ascent seemed to last forever. Maybe that was because of her distorted sense of time. But she also felt that the shadow gallery must be a considerable distance below the ground, this roof some way above it. More to the point, it was lifting her out of the hell that she'd spent an unknown time in, taking her, if not to heaven, at least back into the world she'd left behind. The world that she now realized, having overcome the fear that had so narrowed and limited her options, was a world of infinite possibility. And then the cage door slid back, the outer door was thrown open, and the silence down below was quite forgotten. The night was rent by a rolling cannonade of thunder that made her think of the night he'd blown up the Old Bailey, made her expect at any moment to hear Tchaikovsky struck up upon the wind, and the parallel was given added verisimilitude when jagged, blue, forked lightning split the sky open in a spider-web of stark electric filaments, before the thunder quaked the low and rolling clouds again. But it wasn't the celestial pyrotechnics that interested Evie. It was the rain that tumbled down from the clouds, splashing and hissing on the flat rooftop before her, making mirror pools that reflected back the lightning flashes, so many little pieces of sky down here upon the earth below. "Here," said V, offering his cloak to her. But she simply ignored him. More than that, she wriggled out of the hemp dress she'd worn for far too long, and stepped out naked into the pouring rain. Quietly, peacefully, she raised her head and looked straight up into the sky, felt the heavy raindrops lashing down almost vertically, let them wash over her face, shower over her thin, frail, and battered body. Not washing away her sins, but her sufferings. All gone now, all behind her. And with them, the tempest finally sluiced away her fear for good.
"God is in the rain," she said slowly,
remembering Valerie's words, breathing deeply, filling her lungs as if they'd never been used before. And she knew that Valerie had been right. God, whoever you thought of him, or her, or it, was undoubtedly in the rain, in the clouds, the trees, the buildings, the people, in the rat, in everything. And everything, too, was God. And God wasn't just an Englishman, wasn't Suttler's God, wasn't even Christian. God was everybody's God, or gods, or goddesses, and there was only Godhead in the same way as there was only human. And whether you called God Jehovah, or Allah, Zeus, or Odin, Brahma, or the Jade Emperor, so in the same way whether you were Anglo-Saxon, or African, Arab, Jewish, or Chinese, so you were still called a man, or a woman, or a child. For in the same way that Shylock said, "If you prick us, do we not bleed?" then so the deity, from crucified Christ to idol made of mud, would say besides, "If you worship me, am I not God?" And Eva knew that it was so. And so, for her, it was. And V, watching her, remembered the night he too had achieved this state. Not through water, but through fire. Not in London, but in Larkhill. Not with celestial fireworks, but with explosives of his own. The 5th of November, many years ago, when all the sky was fire, all the world was smoke, and he'd been naked too, not to feel the world upon his skin, but because his clothes had burned off, and much of his skin was, quite simply, gone. An inferno. Not just in the sense of a mighty fire, but in the original meaning of the word, a blazing hell. But somehow, too, a purifying, alchemical flame that burned away the dross of the world, the slag, and left only the silver and the gold. And not only his sufferings had been brought to an end that night, but those of many others besides, one way or another, for better or for worse. And if he had been released that night, then to what greater task could he commit himself thereafter than the release of others still, perhaps of all the world?
"Everything's so different," Evie said softly, gently,
almost inaudibly through the rain, but just loud enough to draw his attention back from that night of his own, when there'd been no such quiet words, but rather screams and roars. And so it should be. For this was her night, a night the like she'd never known before and never would again. And he would do his best to feel it with her, for all these experiences were as different, always, as they were the same. Not far away from him, still out there on the roof in a world of tumbling water, Evie began to weep, her tears mingling with the rain, and she, in just the same way, felt her entire being becoming merged with the infinite all. Overhead, the dancing lightning rent the sky once more with fierce celestial brilliance, cried, "I am," as gods had always done, personified in light. Illumination. Enlightenment. 18. Days had passed, blurring into weeks, much as they had in her supposed prison. And again Evie had little conception of the passing of time. Not now because of the continued psychological torture that had slowly scoured away her former fears, but because time itself no longer mattered. Instead there was only the ongoing process of recovery, of feeding and restoring her physical body, of exploring her new mental calm and inner balance, of the previously unappreciated sense not of well-being, but of simply being. Until one day she noticed she had enough hair to riffle her fingers through again, and by the following morning she'd come to a decision. Dressed in street clothes that V had provided, she had to imagine that he had other disguises still with which to go out and shop for her, or perhaps, remembering how he'd acquired his artworks, to steal for her, and with her bag fully packed, she found V in the main room of the Shadow Gallery, standing contemplatively by the jukebox, seemingly lost in a world of his own. Or was he plotting further moves in his campaign to bring about the anarchy that he saw as the only answer to the repressions of the fascist state? Even if he didn't wear the expressionless mask, she thought she'd never quite know exactly how his deepest thought processes worked, for despite the little he'd told her of his own history, and the insights given to her during her own imprisonment, she still didn't understand quite what sort of hell he'd gone through at Larkhill. And perhaps, now that the main perpetrators had died at his hand, no one but V ever would. "V," she began, not knowing any way to say this except shortly, and besides, there was no point in doing anything else but coming straight out with it. "I'm leaving." It hadn't been an easy decision. Outside, the world was harsh, uncaring, dangerous, full of the things that used to scare her so badly that she'd been running away from all her life. And she knew her old life was over anyway. She couldn't go back to her job, her friends, her few surviving relatives, even if she wanted to. What had happened to Gordon Dietrich had been a lesson in itself. She couldn't let the same thing happen again to anyone she knew or held dear, and it would, simply because they knew her. But here in the Shadow Gallery was security, and art, and wonder. The sort of marvellous haven she'd always dreamed of, to be revealed by the magic word she'd always hoped to discover. But now she knew that she no longer needed safe havens like that. She'd found the magic word, and it hadn't turned out to be anything like what she'd expected at all. It was, "I'd rather die behind the chemical sheds." "There are 872 songs in here," V eventually said, distractedly, without turning round to look at her. "I've listened to all of them, but I've never danced to any of them."
"Did you hear me?"
she asked, a little taken aback.
"Yes." "I can't stay here," she told him flatly,
wondering if, having heard, he still didn't quite understand her. "I know," he said, finally turning away from the jukebox to face her, the smile on the mask seeming sympathetic now, despite that it never changed. Or perhaps it was just the way he held his head, the language of his body. No, it was more than that. She could read his voice much better now, with all its minor inflections and changes of tone, its subtle shades of meaning. "You won't find any more locked doors here." She crossed the room toward him, reaching into her bag as she did so, searching for something she'd gone back to her cell to retrieve.
"I thought about keeping this,"
she began, finally pulling out the small roll of toilet paper that was Valerie's letter.
"But it didn't feel right. Knowing you wrote it."
"I didn't." It was such a simple statement, so simply delivered that she had to believe him. Even so, it came as a complete surprise, shattering another illusory item in her mental picture of things that she'd taken as obviously true. "Can I show you something before you go?" he asked then. Rather hesitantly, never knowing quite what to expect when V had things to show her, she nodded. He led her away through the shadow gallery then, took her to yet another room she hadn't seen before. The place seemed endless, a labyrinthine collection of rooms beyond rooms, connected by passages that wound around each other, seeming to go nowhere but finally ending up somewhere quite amazing, all lit only in the most subdued manner, a maze of mysterious gloom and marvel. But what he showed her when he opened up this particular door was perhaps the most surprising yet. The room within was, quite plainly, a shrine. Beneath the same vaulted ceiling found elsewhere in the shadow gallery, the cold severity of the stone walls was softened by richly woven tapestries. The floor was strewn with the sort of thick Persian rugs she'd only seen previously in Bishop Lilliman's bedroom. For a moment that gave her pause for thought, about the hypocrisy that could hide behind the mask of proper organized religions conducting their ceremonies in the plain light of day, and how it contrasted with the obvious and sincere reverence with which V had established this memorial room, and, she was certain, never shown it to another soul before now. There may have been no deity worshipped here, but it was plain that he kept it holy nonetheless. To either side of the room, beneath chain-suspended grow lights, were beds of blooming roses. Violet Carson roses. As V led her forward to the inner sanctum, she noticed another bed of violet Carsons growing on what seemed to be the top of some sort of altar, and just beyond that she saw the inner sanctum. A portrait stood in the centre, but pasted on the walls all around this were photos, movie posters, press cuttings and reviews featuring the same woman as the painting. For a moment, Evie couldn't quite understand this previously unrevealed and apparently sentimental side to V's nature, for this was obviously something rather more special than the random collection of old horror and gangster movie posters elsewhere in the shadow gallery. This was about a single person, and one that he obviously held particularly dear. But then she noticed the name of the actress. Valerie Page. And one of the posters was for the Salt Flats.
"She was real?" Evie asked softly, wonder in her voice.
She began to feel awkward holding the bag and put it on the floor. For just a little while this woman had seemed so important to her, so real, and then so false, when the nature of the prison was revealed. Now apparently real again, both she and reality in general seemed suddenly completely fluid, to the point where reality and falsehood became merged, were transcended. V nodded in answer to her question, bringing her back to a state where, at least in some circumstances, real was important after all. And in doing so he displayed a real sense of veneration, despite the mask.
"She's beautiful," said Evie,
affected by the same feeling herself.
"Did you know her?"
"No," said V quietly. "She wrote the letter just before she died. I delivered it to you in the same way it had been delivered to me."
"Then it really happened, didn't it?"
said Evie, suddenly overwhelmed. For a while after she discovered that all that had occurred during her detention had been no more than a puppet play where V had pulled the strings, she thought that Valerie's letter was just a fraud. Felt, because of the way it had affected her so deeply, that this was perhaps the greatest betrayal in all the things he'd done to her, necessary though they might have been. But now all the sympathy she'd had for Valerie's suffering came back to her with redoubled force. And with it, a new empathy with V.
"You were in the cell next to her,"
she asked, knowing the answer before he nodded an affirmation. So he, then, must have experienced much the same feelings as she had, reading that painful testament of the soon-to-be-dead.
"And that's what this is all about, then,"
she continued, not in any accusatory fashion, but simply stating what had suddenly become plainly obvious to her.
"You're getting back at them for what they did to her, and to you."
"And to us all," she might have added, thinking of how Sutler's thuggery had extended out far beyond the detention camps and interrogation centres, like an all-encompassing cancer that had turned the whole country rotten, made it hell to live in.
"What they did to me created me," he told her. "It's a basic principle of the universe that every action will create an equal and opposing reaction."
"Is that how you see it?"
Evie asked, still fascinated, even though she was just about to leave, by the surprises his mental processes threw up, and how they could switch instantly from the apparently sentimental to the almost repellently methodical.
"Like an equation."
"What they did was monstrous,"
he replied with a sense of simple acceptance, a plain statement of fact that no longer carried any emotional charge.
"And they created a monster,"
she added equally emotionlessly, equally without moral judgment.
Whatever he might have thought of her summing up, V said nothing, merely watching her as she bent to pick up her bag once more, and for a few moments they stood there in silence, looking at each other, perhaps for the last time.
Then she handed him Valerie's letter, watched him as he reverently placed it back on the shrine from which he'd taken it those days or weeks before, and somehow felt the same sense of reverence herself. As if, in leaving the shadow gallery, she was now about to say goodbye to two people, rather than just the one she'd expected.
"Do you know where you'll go?" he asked eventually.
"No."
She couldn't help breaking out into a smile.
"That would have scared me before. I suppose I should thank you for that."
On a sudden impulse, she stepped toward him and looked up into the frozen smile that served him for a face, almost as if she were about to kiss him. But what was the point of kissing a mask?
"Thank you,"
Evie said, adding, just as she was about to turn away,
"and goodbye."
But before she could leave the shrine, just as she felt that she couldn't resist turning back for a last glance at him before she disappeared from his life forever, he called her name.
"Evie, can I ask you for something?"
She nodded, wondering what he could have in mind, wondering what she'd do if, at this last minute, he asked her to stay.
"If I had one wish," he said, and a note of urgent sadness in his voice emphasized the importance of his request, "it would be to see you again, if only once, before the fifth."
For a moment she stood there, considering. Would it be better just to make a clean break? To put all this behind her, to never see him again? But after all he'd done for her, whether she'd wanted him to or not, perhaps she could do this one small thing for him in return.
"All right,"
she said softly, graciously, with a smile that, somehow, forgave him all his sins.
"Thank you," he said, returning her a smile that was ever the same, ever fixed, eternally unreadable. And with that she turned and left him. Left, wondering how she'd get on without him. Wondering how he'd get on without her.
19. High Chancellor Adam Sutler glared down from the large screen in the cabinet room, clearly far from happy with the situation being reported to him by his department heads. Were these really the best men available? And were they really making their best efforts to deal with this terrorist imbroglio? Perhaps if he had one of them killed, in full view, pour encourager les autres. Etheridge, for example, the useless little toad.
"Based on random audio sweeps," the potential victim was saying now, mumbling nervously as he picked his way through the report he had on the cabinet table before him, doing his best to summarize what he knew the Chancellor could only regard as appallingly bad news.
I've projected that right now 80% of the public believe the terrorist is still alive.
Etheridge gulped, took a sip of water from the glass before him, and continued.
We are showing a 12% increase over last month's positive mentions in all four quadrants.
The Chancellor's glare was withering. Did Hitler have to put up with underlings like these? You get rid of all the scum to make way for your purebred Norsefire Superman, and you end up with this? As if he knew what his master was thinking, Etheridge tried to shrink back into the shadows, to become invisible, to disappear from view. If only they could make the current unrest disappear as well. On the larger scale, apart from the activities of the terrorist himself, it was little more than talk so far, and an increase in slogan painting and poster defacement. But it was a worrying sign. And there were areas in the East End where they were starting to vandalize the security cameras, where petty crime was increasing, where the police thought it best to patrol in pairs.
"Mr. Creedy?"
Sutler snapped next, and even the normally cool, calm head of the finger looked a little uncomfortable at the Chancellor's tone.
"We're handling it as best we can, Chancellor."
Peter Creedy did his best to sound businesslike and efficient.
"Our arrests are as high as they've been since the reclamation."
That was something to be proud of, surely. Or if not that, at least it showed that he and his men were on the ball, doing their job. That there seemed to be more and more people out there who needed to be arrested was, perhaps, something not really to be gone into just now. Even so, he wasn't quite prepared for Sutler's reaction.
"I want more than arrests!"
he shouted furiously, changing his mind about Etheridge, thinking Creedy would provide a far more effective object lesson.
"I want results!"
For a few seconds, the very silence seemed to hum with the violence of the Chancellor's outburst, and the assembled department heads could do nothing but look down at the table before them, averting their gazes, nerves taut, minds racing. Was the old tyrant starting to lose it? Was this damned terrorist situation actually starting to get to him? And if he was becoming unstable, what about the fallout? Who'd catch the flak? More to the point, who'd eventually come out on top, with his boot on the neck of the others, if there were any others left? Eventually the silence was broken by the rustle of papers being nervously shuffled, as they prepared to move on to the next item on the agenda, hoping that, by the time they got to it, Sutler's glowering face would have settled back into something more like its normal expression. Only Eric Finch allowed himself the slightest of smirks at Creedy's discomfort. Serve the bastard right. After all the shit he'd been giving Finch lately, it was about time the evil sod got it in the neck for a change. Finally, Conrad Hare cleared his throat nervously.
"I beg your pardon, Chancellor," he began tentatively, not sure why it had fallen on him to bring up the matter of the report that the various department heads had communally been responsible for assembling. Or all but one of them, anyway. He'd rather expected Creedy to press forward with the presentation, grabbing all the attention as usual, but after the bollocking the finger man had just got, perhaps it wasn't surprising that he didn't. Dascombe didn't give a shit about the Houses of Parliament, so long as his news teams were on site to report events. And Etheridge certainly wasn't the man for the job. Finch wouldn't anyway, so it was down to him.
"I know no one wants to discuss this," he continued with a rather accusing glance at his silent companions, then started to get into his stride. "But if we're to be prepared for every eventuality, then it can't be ignored any longer. The Red Report before this meeting has been vetted by several demolition specialists. It concludes that the most logical delivery system for the terrorist to use would be an airborne attack." He paused, having brought the important matters to the Chancellor's attention, and glanced round toward Finch. Well, he supposed one more thing had to be said, ridiculous as everyone else had agreed it was. "However, a separate report has been filed suggesting an underground train, despite the fact that the tunnels surrounding Parliament have been sealed shut."
"Who filed that report?"
Sutler asked, the sneer on his face already suggesting what he thought of the idea.
"Chief Inspector Finch,"
Hare told him, passing the buck with considerable alacrity.
"Do you have any evidence to support that conclusion, Inspector?"
said the Chancellor from the screen, fixing Finch with a stare.
"No, sir,"
he replied honestly. After all, he didn't.
Just a feeling.
If I am sure of anything, Inspector Finch, said Sutler with cold, heavy emphasis, it is that this government will not survive if it is to be subject to your feelings.
Across the table, Creedy grinned wolfishly at Finch, returning contempt for contempt, with added interest besides. Well, thought Finch, they'd see. And he'd far rather trust a copper's instincts than he would the absolute certainties of a jumped-up Nazi throwback like Adam Sutler. If he trusted anyone, or anything at all, any longer. Finch knew the look on Dominic's face as the young man entered the office they shared at New Scotland Yard and closed the door behind him, even before he gave the signal they'd arranged. Even so, Finch thought, as he pulled out the debugging device from his desk and switched it on, his assistant was looking particularly harassed this morning.
"My friend inside the finger came up with something,"
Dominic said quietly, despite the device. Then, with a furtive glance around him, even though he knew full well they were quite alone, he reached into his pocket and handed Finch a disk, which the latter immediately began loading into his computer.
"There were three men," Dominic said, joining his boss behind the desk as the file began to open. "Covert intelligence. Original black baggers. All under Creedy."
"Alan Percy?" Finch began to read from the screen. "Robert Keyes and William Rookwood."
"The day after the St. Mary's outbreak," Dominic filled in for him. "Percy gave his Beretta a blowjob, Keyes dies in a fire, and—"
"Rookwood goes missing," Finch concluded for him, looking at the information on the screen.
"Bloody coincidences are making me sick to my stomach,"
Dominic remarked, no longer believing in coincidence any more than Finch did.
"Rookwood?"
Finch asked meditatively, trying to put his finger on something he couldn't quite remember.
"Rookwood? Why do I know that name?"
A hunch, an instinct, one of those feelings Sutler despised so much, and Finch opened his mailbox, typed the name into the search facility, and found an unopened email from William Rookwood.
"Holy Christ!"
exclaimed Dominic softly, looking over his boss's shoulder. Finch opened the message and began to read it. "Dear Inspector, I understand you're looking for me. I can only assume this means you are ready for the truth. If so, return this email and I will send contact details. W.R.
"He must have had a hidden trip on his file at the finger," Dominic said, though his satisfaction at working out the solution soon gave way to puzzlement again. "But how'd he know it was you?"
Finch shook his head. Sometimes there were questions even Copper's instincts couldn't answer.
"So what do we do?"
Dominic asked nervously, fearing the answer but guessing it already. "I'm a cop," Finch told him, clicking on the reply button. "I have to know."
"Shit,"
breathed Dominic softly, horribly afraid that that was exactly what they were going to get into. The St. Mary's Mausoleum and Memorial was one of those huge memorial buildings that fascist imperialist regimes seemed to do so well, or so badly, depending on one's personal taste. Gigantic, imposing, monumental, the sort of tribute the hapless victims so richly deserved, or overblown, overbearing, and oppressive, the sort of monstrosity an evil government erected to make it feel better about itself. For Finch and Dominic, there wasn't any argument about which.
"I came when they opened it," the younger man shuddered. "Gave me the collywobbles."
He looked around him at the fountains, the lilies, the centerpiece statue of playing children, their angelic faces frozen into cold eternity by the snow-white marble, their running legs never quite going anywhere, and the toys and games they held unplayed, at the vast line of slabs engraved and gilded with the names of what seemed the near-infinite dead.
"Still does," Dominic added, and Finch knew exactly what he meant.
He'd never been a great fan of mortuary sculpture, beautiful as he knew the Christs and angels in the alcoves round the walls to be, and what was worse about this place was that, for all it looked like a fond and loving tribute to the little ones who died, and a fitting replacement for St. Mary's School, now demolished,
It was actually built on the site of the playground where they'd excavated the mass grave to dump the bodies into before the infection spread. A massive tombstone, then, built on a giant grave. Still, they hadn't come to contemplate the past, but to disinter it. And the man they needed to help them do that was William Rookwood. The place seemed largely empty at this time of the morning. It was after the still grieving relatives had paid their respects on their way to work, before the school parties were brought along by their teachers. Round at the back was a museum section with photos and memorabilia of the victims and the school, most of the latter almost certainly false, considering the way the clean-up crews had eradicated everything while disinfecting. The Museum of Dead Children, it was commonly known as, and organized visits were a compulsory part of the curriculum of all the schools in London to learn the lessons of history and the necessity of vigilance against the threats of the future. A history, Finch now suspected, was completely false. A future threat, he thought, less likely to come from without than from those who were actually supposed to protect the citizens of tomorrow. But the place wasn't entirely empty. A soft cough brought to their attention a man sitting on a marble bench in a shadowy corner of the memorial, almost hidden by a bed of pure white lilies. Finch and Dominic glanced toward each other, then started toward him. "That's close enough, Inspector," said the man silently, and they stared at him, remembering the tall, relatively slim, clean-shaven man that Rookwood had appeared to be from the photo in his file. Instead, they saw a large, almost fat and heavily bearded man wearing dark glasses, a wide-brimmed hat pulled down low to shade his face, and a heavy, dark coat. By his side was a small bag, and his gloved hands fiddled with a heavy, silver-headed cane that would obviously double as a weapon, even if it didn't contain the blade Finch rather suspected it did. The beard looked real enough, but Dominic thought the coat covered several layers of padding. Not surprisingly, Rookwood lived in darkness and disguise. Outside it began to rain again, beating a soft tattoo on the marble paving surrounding the memorial, and bringing an added chill to the air. As if Eric Finch didn't already feel cold enough inside, when he thought about everything they'd uncovered so far, and which, he suspected, was probably going to get far worse by the time they'd finished interviewing their man. "You're Rookwood?" Finch asked, receiving a nod in reply. And then the man reached into his bag and drew out a debugging device very much like Finch's and turned it on. "We're not wired," Finch told him. Knowing very well Rookwood would be a fool to take him at his word, but feeling he wanted to say it anyway.
"I'm sorry," Rookwood said, "but a man in my position only survives by taking every precaution."
Finch nodded understandingly, gesturing toward a bench not far from the one on which Rookwood sat, and, when the latter appeared to give his consent, sitting down on it with Dominic. "You have information for us?" Finch asked.
"No. You already have the information."
Rookwood nodded his head forward and seemed to sink even farther down into the shadows.
"All the names and dates are inside your head. What you want, what you really need, is a story."
"A story can be true or false," Finch remarked, a touch exasperated. This was supposed to be an investigation, not a game.
"I leave such judgments to you, Inspector."
The ghost of a smile played round Rookwood's bearded lips, barely visible in the shadow. Then he tapped his cane on the marble floor, as if calling for his audience's attention.
"Our story begins, as these stories often do," said Rookwood, "with a young, up-and-coming politician. He is a deeply religious man and a member of the Conservative Party. He is completely single-minded and, before too long, regardless of the political process."
Finch knew well enough to whom Rookwood was referring. Adam Sutler, swiftly outgrowing his conservative roots, setting up his own Norse Fire organization that so many people had initially regarded as a joke. Adam Sutler, the man who talks to God, they'd called him derisively, in those days when God had long been declared dead, hardly foreseeing the crushing return the church would make a few years later, reorganized now as an arm of the party. They'd also said a neo-Nazi outfit like Norse Fire would never take root here, not in England, not in the mother of democracy. Called them nasties,
and laughed every time they were mentioned, quite forgetting Oswald Mosley's black shirts back before the Second World War, forgetting that had been a movement that had appealed to all classes of society, from the working-class bigot to the aristocratic toff. It was led by Sir Oswald Mosley, after all, while most of its supporters came from the East End. But if they did remember Mosley, it was only as an old joke, a minor aberration, certainly not a serious warning. And they also failed to remember Thatcher, Blair, and all the others who'd sent the country lurching dangerously toward the right, but had made a better show of disguising their intentions. Good, honest Christians, too, the lot of them. History's lessons. Still unlearned. Even when the rallies had started, when the symbols started to appear, the double crosses, which with hindsight should have tipped someone off as to what was going on, even when the armbands and the uniforms appeared, the red and black motifs, when the salutes began, surely it should have been obvious by then. But no, fascists the world over have always known how to put on a good show, to play the crowd, to give the people what they want, and once they've got the fatheads in and listening, to tell them what they want to hear. Or at least to tell them what the party propaganda had already persuaded them that they wanted to hear, after that same propaganda had subverted the information they received, their moral values, their very humanity. The same old messages of hate, that the country's full of degenerates and idolaters, especially in the schools where they can corrupt the helpless children, that hordes of asylum seekers are taking the jobs, that all the Arab ragheads are nothing but terrorists in disguise, that the Yids have got the money, the Gippos are nothing but a bunch of burglars, the Yardie gangs have got the protection rackets sewn up, all the Vice is run by Albanian immigrants, the Triads are smuggling in more foreigners every day, and there's no point going into town tonight unless you want to eat curry. And then there are the Spics, the Wops, the Krauts, and worst of all, the Frogs. Quite plainly communists to a man. Put them all on the boat back home and sink it when they leave. England for the English! Strength through unity! Unity through faith! England prevails! Rookwood's words broke into Finch's memories.
The more power he attains, the more obvious his zealotry, the more aggressive his supporters become.
It was true enough, after all. Finch had seen it, lived through it, and though it seemed more and more shameful to him now, the more of this poisonous filth he was uncovering, he'd joined the party way back then. All the police were doing it, just as they used to join the Freemasons. In a world where law and order were becoming the paramount watchwords, it was the obvious way to get on. He wasn't alone in selling his soul. None of them were. But he'd sold his soul nonetheless, and he'd had to live with it ever since. All he would say in his own defense was that he hadn't actually attended a rally since the Reclamation, not since his wife and son had died.
"Eventually," said Rookwood, "his party launches a special project in the name of national security."
And Finch could guess exactly what that project was, and where it was besides. Larkhill.
"At first it is believed to be a search for biological weapons, and is pursued without regard to its cost," that all-knowing voice continued, hardly needing to add, and entirely without the knowledge of the public at large. But, Finch thought, there was something wrong here, for Rookwood seemed to be talking about events before the Reclamation,
and that would imply that the Larkhill project had started much earlier than he'd suspected, and presumably with the acquiescence of the government of the day, who, with the Americans at war and the world going to hell, were already involved in the detainment without trial of undesirables. He remembered how they'd been more than happy to wash their hands of blame and pass the running of the camps to private security firms, and how the worst one, Security Corps, had swiftly become known as Secura Corps. But now he had to guess that they were nothing more than Norse Fire Fronts, and the government must have turned a blind eye to whatever went on there, too.
"However," Rookwood's story went on, "the true goal of this project is power, complete and total, hegemonic domination. The project, however, ends violently."
Again Finch could fill in the details, having read Delia Surridge's journal and knowing how, after all the deaths, the secret mass graves and the lost records, V had brought things to an explosive, fiery conclusion.
"But the efforts of those involved are not in vain, for a new ability to wage war is born from the blood of one of the victims. Imagine a virus
the most terrifying virus you can, and then imagine that you, and you alone, have the cure.
So, thought Finch, that confirmed what it was that Delia had been working on. What she couldn't even bring herself to quite put down in her journal, even though it had obviously been there by implication.
But if your ultimate goal is power, how best to use such a weapon? It is at this point in our story that along comes a spider. He is a man seemingly without a conscience, for whom the ends always justify the means. His name is not Adam Sutler. It is Peter Creedy. It is he who suggests that their target should not be an enemy of the country, but rather, the country itself. Three targets are chosen to maximize the effect of the attack: a school, a tube station, and a water treatment plant.
There it was, then, Finch thought, looking round to see an equally horrified expression on Dominic's face. St. Mary's, Tottenham Court Road tube, three waters. And it hadn't been religious extremists from the Middle East with stolen American biological weapons at all. It had all been that cold-hearted bastard Creedy's idea. Peter Creedy, head of the Finger, government linchpin, top party man, mass murderer.
"Several hundred die within the first few weeks," Rookwood cut across Finch's thoughts, reminding him of the St. Mary's virus panic in the days of what he could now see was a completely phony epidemic, spreading when the situation couldn't be contained.
Or, no, the virus was real enough, as were the deaths and the further outbreaks, mainly in Scotland, Ireland, and Wales. Not England, after the first attacks. Finch remembered now, and that made a grisly sort of sense, too. Oh, yes, plenty of real deaths. It was the spin put upon them that was a lie.
"Fueled by the media, fear and panic spread quickly, fracturing and dividing the country until at last the true goal comes into view. Before the St. Mary's crisis, no one could have predicted the results of the election that year. No one."
Sutler had become Prime Minister in a landslide victory, of course. Tough on terror Sutler, with his promises to reform the laws so that this could never happen again, to bring back detention without trial on a huge scale, to make the country a safe place for decent English people to live and work in. And the electorate had bought it big time, without realizing that was just the start, the one small part of the much larger plan that was yet to be revealed. So many Northfire members had packed the House of Commons that it had taken only a few weeks for them to abolish the House of Lords and rewrite, or rather write for the first time, a replacement for the unwritten constitution that had served the country well enough for 1,000 years. It was only a matter of time before Parliament effectively abolished itself as well, becoming nothing more than the rubber-stamp assembly for Sutler's political machine that it remained to this day. And all the elections since then had shown a 95% return for the Northfire Party, no matter how the electorate actually voted. The more he thought about it, and the more he grappled with the implications, the more Finch realized that the cover-up must have been much more thorough than he'd realized. For everything he'd seen had suggested to him that Larkhill was just another of the many camps set up during the Reclamation, that gross clean-up when the immigrants and degenerates had been persuaded to leave either the country or the very world itself, which had begun as soon as the party felt sufficiently confident of its position in power. Now, it seemed, Larkhill's entire operation had run its course before then. No wonder files had been lost, dates altered, details changed. Could any of the records be trusted any more? Was there any such thing as history now? But then, as they always said, truth is the first casualty of war. And the Reclamation had certainly been a war. A cancerous attack when England had turned against itself and destroyed too large a percentage of its own population to comfortably think about.
"And then," Rookwood took up the story again, "not long after the election, lo and behold, a miracle! Some believed it was the work of God himself, but it was more the work of a pharmaceutical company controlled by certain party members that made them all obscenely rich. Viadox."
Certain party members, undoubtedly Prothero, but probably all the other major players at Larkhill too, though they must have hidden their interests more thoroughly than the late Voice of London. Maybe Lilliman's apparently high salary was some sort of back-dated cover for the profits he'd siphoned off, too. A year later, several extremists are tried, found guilty, and executed, while a memorial is built to canonize their victims.
Ah, yes. What about those extremists, then? Presumably they must all have been stooges, well-paid stooges, no doubt, who learned their lines and said their piece in court, who confessed, were found guilty, and then, when the execution date came round, were quietly smuggled out of the country. Easily enough done when the days of public executions were long since past, except that, knowing Creedy as he did, Finch couldn't see it working quite like that. Probably they received promises that they'd be quietly smuggled out of the country and had, when the time came, been executed anyway. Probably by Creedy in person. Dead men tell no tales.
But the ultimate result? The true genius of the plan was the fear. Fear became the ultimate tool of this government, and through it our original politician was ultimately appointed to the newly created position of High Chancellor. The rest, as they say, Rookwood concluded with a knowing smile, is history.
History, thought Finch ruefully, remembering his ruminations of a moment earlier, remembering too the words of Henry Ford. History is bunk.
Can you prove any of this? He asked sharply,
still not entirely sure that what Rookwood had told them was 100% true.
Why do you think I'm still alive?
His informant replied, a mischievous twinkle in his eye. But if he expected some response to that, it wasn't forthcoming.
Every time Creedy needed something done below the radar, he continued after a few moments, he'd come to me personally. I never liked him, never trusted him. So when he asked me to deliver the virus to St. Mary's, I secretly recorded the conversation, like I often did.
Finch and Dominic exchanged glances. This was what they'd been waiting to hear, the clincher that would prove their case.
All right, Finch said, turning back to the man before them. We'd like to take you into protective custody, Mr. Rookwood.
I'm sure you would, Rookwood sniggered. But if you want that recording, you'll do what I tell you to do.
He stood up then, supporting himself on his cane as if age and obesity made the action difficult for him.
Put Creedy under 24-hour surveillance, Rookwood demanded next,
and that, thought Finch, was something he'd do with great pleasure, knowing how Creedy had been doing exactly the same thing to him. He nodded, waiting to see if the man had anything